This is the Country Hour with Megan Hughes on ABC Radio Queensland.
Good afternoon. Thank you for your company. So, US President Donald Trump has unveiled a $12 billion aid package for American farmers impacted by the fallout of his tariffs. It's to help farmers buy seeds, fertilizer, and other expenses for next year's growing season. Australia sends a lot of red meat into America and competes with US exporters in markets like China. So, what will the impact be on Australian farmers? Well, Natasha Kemp is head of food, beverage and agribusiness at ING Australia. She explains what the details are of this new arrangement and what it'll mean for Australian growers.
To break that down, so that's about $12 billion US is about Australian dollar equivalent of about $18 billion. And that's really going to support farmers that are farming what they call row crops. So major crops such as corn, soybean, wheat, cotton and rice. And they're getting the bulk of the support for about $11 billion. And then there's a little bit of support. That's $1 billion for specialty crops, fruit, nuts and vegetables. So they're basically direct cash transfers that are going into the accounts of the US farmers. And we understand that to be happening in February next year. And so what that is really doing is supporting those farmers, you know, potentially they've had high input costs or they might have been seeing lower cost of their various commodity. And so that bridge payment is just to really bolster that segment of the economy.
So how have they been impacted by these tariffs and this trade war that the administration has been in?
So just say, you know, we all look at the trade war being US and China specific, but actually it's potentially lesser known retaliatory tariffs that actually might have been affecting them. So for example, the US export a lot of soybean into China. They've stopped doing that this year. And I think it wasn't until September this year, or actually maybe even October, that the first soybean exports into China happened. So as a result, you know, there's a lot of soybean in the market trying to find a home. And really that has an impact on, or could have an impact on price. In the interesting sort of, what I'd say a juxtaposition is that the price of soybeans actually went up this year because they were using it for alternative fuels and things like that. But the other sort of row crops like corn and wheat, that the price of those commodities has fallen.
What does this mean for Australian farmers? Because Australia is sending a lot of red meat, in particular cattle and goat meat, into the US market. And I guess, you know, where they're not sending grains into the US market, they will be competing with the US into markets like China. So would this subsidy have a bit of a backlash on Australian farmers?
Some, but not all. So let's start with the broadacre crops like grains and oilseeds. So I think you're right in terms of it's likely to have downward pressure on price. But in addition to that, we're coming into another really large Australian crop. But globally, the supply of grain is high. So potentially you would see, or it would follow, that the price of those grains would fall. So you would argue not great for an Australian farmer growing those crops. You know, that said, the crop is in plentiful supply. And, you know, I think, you know, you always have these issues with supply and demand. So I think over sort of long range, you think 2-3 year time, I think there might be a temporary price dip, but you would expect a recovery. For our beef farmers, I think if you use that example, the cost of grain is going down. That actually potentially has a really good effect on beef producers. So you think a lot of our beef will eventually go into a feedlot, and you would be feeding those animals things like grain, soybean. So therefore, the cost of that import would go down. And so potentially, there is actually an opportunity for those processors or some of those farmers potentially to see better outcomes there. In addition, and this is kind of how I always think of food and agri, it's all like, you know, a global ecosystem. We still have a great opportunity here in Australia to support beef into the US. So they are still at a low point in their herd and they will continue to rebuild their herd. And as a result, the Australian beef is required over in the US. So we think that, you know, we don't really see this support or this one-off support for the US farmers necessarily impacting beef and livestock producers here in Australia in the short term. Mm. It potentially actually might benefit them by way of cheaper input prices in terms of the feed.
Do you think there'll be a case of exporters and growers choosing to just store grain and oil seeds to wait for better prices?
Potentially. I think that's always the million-dollar question, isn't it? Do you keep, you know, you've obviously got to pay for storage, or a lot of farmers are now have already invested in a lot of on-farm storage. So do you hold expecting the price to go up or not? I think, you know, that's something that I think most farmers would have an understanding of, and in terms of that would be their strategy. I wouldn't comment on that because it just really depends on, I guess, various things like farmer cash flow and cost of storage and things like that.
Yeah, so like an individual decision rather than an industry decision.
Yeah, exactly. But even like, for example, there might be farmers that, you know, might need to sell now because they're looking to do some capital works coming up, or, you know, as we get closer to the end of the financial year, they might delay selling, you know, due to, you know, various implications around tax or cash flow. So, yeah, I think it's a really individual sort of set of circumstances that each farmer, you know, works through. You know, looking at the market over the various years I've been doing this, I think the guidance, if there's any to offer, is that during these times, it's always good to stay the course and keep to your strategy. I think you might need to look at different tweaks here and there, so tactical actions. But I think in the long term, this to me looks to be a market disruption that isn't systemic. It's something that is happening to us. And I think over a period of time, things should revert back to how they were. In Australia, we're very lucky. We're not the cheapest in terms of ag exports, but we are the most trusted. We are a quality supplier. We're quite close to Asia. We've got all these things around quality and food safety acting in our interest, and we'll always be, you know, a reliable export partner. So I think that is always going to be, you know, that is actually the fundamental of Australian agriculture that is very exciting. And it's, you know, I think we will, in these times where there's a lot of volatility, if we stick to our knitting per se, I think we will come out a winner.
Natasha Kemp is Head of Food, Beverage and Agribusiness at ING, speaking there. Now, from exports to imports, seafood industry experts say it'll be a backward step for biosecurity if the federal government adopts a proposal to move disease testing of raw imported prawns offshore. Testing was beefed up after a 2017 Senate inquiry examined failures which allowed white spot disease to enter Australia in uncooked imported prawns. Now, white spot disease doesn't pose health risks to humans, but is highly contagious to crustaceans. And they say, the industry says there's a double standard because prawns from infected areas of southeast Queensland and northern New South Wales are required to be cooked, while raw prawns continue to be imported from countries struggling to contain the disease. Jennifer Nichols has this story.
Currently, samples are taken and tested from 100% of the containers of uncooked imported prawns on arrival in Australia. But last month, the Federal Department of Agriculture announced proposed changes. It released guidelines for the evaluation of overseas pre-export testing of raw prawns headed to Australia. If approved, it would move testing offshore before export, overseen by what the department describes as competent authorities.
The industry is right to be concerned because it's a definite backward step, probably back to the bad old days when we had inadequate controls that allowed white spot into the country.
Dr. Ben Diggles is an aquatic animal health specialist, a disease expert who travels the world providing biosecurity risk assessments to industry and governments. And he's scathing of the proposed testing changes for raw imported prawns.
But this one's crazy because they're devolving responsibility. Because of inadequate funding, they're devolving responsibility for our border controls to countries which have already shown that they can't keep these diseases out. So I think they've painted themselves into a corner with an unnecessarily complicated and unreliable testing regime when they should take note from countries such as New Caledonia, which avoid all these problems by simply requiring all their imported prawns to be cooked.
And how much white spot are you seeing out in the environment? Have you been doing testing in Moreton Bay where you live?
No, well, they're not doing it anymore because they know it's established. It's there. So whenever they look, it's there. So it's considered established.
White spot disease has devastated prawn farming on Queensland's Logan River and New South Wales' Clarence River since Australia's first outbreak in 2016. Farmers and wild caught fishers south of Caloundra and in northern New South Wales cannot move prawns out of their regions without first cooking them.
This comes back to the fact that they're enforcing like a higher level of protection for prawns travelling from Queensland to Western Australia out of, say, the white spot zone than they are importing them from other countries which have a range of other diseases they're not testing for.
Dr. Ben Diggles. The media team at the Federal Agriculture Department has not answered ABC Rural's questions about how many containers of raw imported prawns have tested positive for the diseases they do test for, including white spot and yellowhead viruses, which are deadly to farmed prawns but do not harm humans. But information provided to industry last Friday and seen by the ABC revealed that between the 2020-21 and 2024-25 financial years, 22 containers of raw prawns from Vietnam and Thailand failed testing on arrival and had to be re-exported or destroyed. Queensland Seafood Industry Association Executive Officer David Bobberman describes the proposed testing changes as short-sighted.
I think as an island nation, we need to have a very high bar set to importing unprocessed protein into this country, like, and we do have in most other sources of protein. For whatever reason, seafood seems to be the poor cousin of other proteins like pork, beef, for example, and lamb. Yes, white spot disease is in Moreton Bay and the Clarence River, but that is the only two regions where white spot is endemic. So therefore, we've got to protect the rest of the pristine waterways of Australia.
In a statement, a Federal Agriculture Department spokesperson said the Australian government will never compromise on biosecurity, which protects Australia's $100 billion agriculture, fisheries and forestry industries and our environment. The spokesperson said any pre-export testing arrangements would only be approved following a robust and comprehensive scientific assessment and once countries have met Australia's high standards for equivalence. David Bobberman says we can't take chances with the risk of new introduced disease.
The financial consequences of having white spot or any other marine disease into our waterways would be catastrophic for the industry. Governments around Australia are spending probably combined hundreds of millions of dollars around Australia to prevent the incursion of a biosecurity risk. And here we have what would appear to be a relaxation of that biosecurity barrier. It beggars belief.
When you consider that the former biosecurity chief, Helen Scott Orr, brought in quite strict requirements for testing after the white spot outbreak in the Logan River, which has now spread right throughout Moreton Bay and severely restricted trade for prawn farmers and wild caught fisheries in that area. How does it make sense to you?
Oh, it makes absolutely no sense to me.
Queensland Seafood Industry Association Executive Officer David Boberman ending that report from Jennifer Nichols. It is 20 minutes past 12. Next, a farm safety reminder after a tragedy in Queensland over this past week.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Jones. Join me for breakfast tomorrow morning where you'll get all the breaking news and the current affairs. You also find out what's happening right here in central Queensland. Local breakfast, weekdays from 6:30. On ABC Capricornia.
On your radio, online, and on the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
It's been a pretty bit of a tragic week across southern Queensland's ag sector. The region has seen two serious hay bale incidents within this week. So firstly, on Wednesday at the Roma sale yards, a woman in her 40s died after a hay bale struck her at the facility. Then on the weekend, a man in his 40s was flown to hospital with potentially life-threatening chest injuries after a hay bale fell on him while working on a farm at Dunmore, west of Toowoomba. Felicity Richards is the chair of Farm Safe Australia. She tells David Iliff it's a risk that's being overlooked.
And I just remember as a child, climbing on the small square bales was considered a fantastic activity, but they absolutely can pose a danger, and probably especially to children, if they're not handled carefully, because, yeah, they might individually not be capable of a lot of harm, but a great quantity of them or falling from a great height is absolutely a hazard.
I guess with a lot of farm work, particularly when it comes to operating machinery, you know, there would be, I would imagine, you know, very strict procedures to follow and rules about where you are when a machine starts up and a lot of things in place. Is it the same with hay bale movement, or is it an area that's maybe a little bit overlooked in terms of its potential danger?
I think it is easy to overlook it. I come from a farm myself, and every farm's going to be different, and every work environment where they're handling hay at different facilities is going to be different, and there'll be different levels of procedures that they've put in place. So you might see something quite different at a very small family farm from what you'd see at a big corporate enterprise, for example. But we absolutely all need to make sure we've got processes in place, because they're just as hazardous in any of those environments. And often when we're feeding out, I know from my experience, you're really focused on the animals that you're trying to care for. You're thinking, right, I've just got to get out there, I've just got to make sure they get their tucker. And then we forget about ourselves and how important it is that we are thinking, as you said, about safe perimeters around the workplace, making sure, you know, if we're using trucks and tractors, we absolutely need to be careful about the people around us. Then we need to be thoughtful of the weight of the bales that we're handling and their ability to tip and fall unexpectedly. So it does take some care and preparation, and it's easy to slip into complacency, and we have to really check ourselves against that.
Just out of interest, and just lastly, what is the most dangerous activity, or the activity that results perhaps in the highest number of injuries or worse on Australian farms?
So this year, I'm sorry to say that we've seen 45 fatalities on Australian farms, and the leading agent is the same as last year, which is our side-by-side vehicles. They are closely followed by our quad bikes and our tractors. Those three agents tend to consistently stay at the top as the three most dangerous things that we see on farm. There are absolutely many ways to mitigate against those risks, but we all on farms have to step up and make sure that we are deploying the strategies that we can to mitigate against the risk.
Felicity Richards is the chair of Farm Safe Australia. AgForce Queensland President Shane McCarthy says people should slow down and not take any shortcuts.
So generally it's only when they're being moved with machinery. So they're either being taken off transport and stacked somewhere, or taken from that stack and transported to the yard where the stock are in to feed them. And it's just, generally as a rule, if they're, you know, they're stacked properly, they won't budge or move. But it's just, you know, you can never say never. But generally it's when they're being moved by machinery, yes.
Yeah.
Depending on what shape they are, they come in square or they come in round. The hay is used generally to feed animals that are in yards or something like that, that they normally can't get to natural pastures. So you're moving them from one place to another. You're also maybe lifting them, you know, up and over some stuff or reaching up with the machinery to get them down. So, and some of these bales can be quite heavy. I mean, you know, they can, you know, 500 to 600 kilos in a bale. So, you know, you just need to take the right precautions. Don't go and try and take too much or try and do it too quickly. Sometimes you can do everything the right way and you're concentrating the right way and something outside your control may have an impact on that as well. So tragic accidents, unfortunately, while we try and prevent them and keep them to a bare minimum.
AgForce Queensland President Shane McCarthy.
On your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Thank you for your company on the Country Hour today. My name is Megan Hughes. If you want to join the conversation, you can send me a text on 0487 993 222. 3 million hectares of native title cattle country in southwest Queensland is now protected under Australian law. Federal approval will be required for any works, which include mining and infrastructure, that would impact cultural features on the Mithika cultural landscape after it was added to Australia's National Heritage List on Friday. Josh Gorringe is from the Mithika Aboriginal Corporation and he runs Crispian Yeomans through what this means for traditional owners and also local cattle producers.
To us as Mithika people, it's very significant. It obviously highlights how significant Mithika Country is, and obviously Mithika Country being in sort of the heart of the Channel Country as well as a part of the Lake Eyre Basin. So it's really significant to us because it helps protect those two areas.
What sites are we talking about here?
Well, we've got the Gunya site out there, which is the old houses, I suppose. They were dated back to, I think it was 1765, around those dates. The latest that we can know that they were used was in the 50s. One of the pastoralists were telling us, neighbouring pastoralists there, that said, yeah, they were used in the 50s.
By Mithika peoples?
By Indigenous people, yeah, stuck there in the flood. I think he said they were moving horses or something for one of the pastoralists and they used them then. Then you've got the sites like the grindstone quarries, which are the largest known quarry sites for the manufacture of grindstones anywhere that we know of in the world, as well as you got big stone arrangement areas and stuff like that, ceremony areas, the scar trees. Probably the unique thing of having the whole landscape under this blanket protection is everything that's out there that's culturally sensitive is now well and truly covered by the National Heritage.
Right. So, Josh, what does that mean in terms of, as Mithika people, what does a protection listing mean?
So probably the biggest thing for us, it's education. It's about nationally recognising that Indigenous people, First Nations people lived here and thrived on the country that we all use every day of the week now for cattle production and other things like that. But it just gives us that little bit extra protection where if mining and other stuff want to come along, that's just another little sort of protection that the country can have
right
to better protect it. And it not only protects us, it protects our neighbours north, south and east, west of us, because obviously anything that happens upstream can affect what happens downstream.
Josh, you're talking about other pastoral companies potentially and other traditional owner groups?
Yeah. Like if stuff happens up north that's going to affect the primary production down this way as well as our native title rights, we have that little bit more say to help not do it or help do it to better protect the country.
And it looks like to me, Josh, that Australia's laws say that any works that might impact area of cultural significance, and that includes Mithika cultural landscape now that it's been protected under the National Heritage List, any works that might impact or negatively impact those sites will now need approval from a federal level.
Yes, that is correct, yeah. Primary production, the way the Pastoralist Act and work on the country now out here is reasonably good, and everyone sort of looks after country because obviously, like I said, it's a harsh climate, but it's a very productive area if you look after it. So a lot of the pastoralists out here want to protect it better and maintain it how it is.
Josh, do you think there might be some concern among pastoralists and cattle producers in the region and what this listing might mean for their operation? There's about at least 10 properties that are located in part or largely on Mithika country.
We had, I think it was about a three-month period where cattle stations and mining companies and the towns and the shires had ample opportunity to put submissions in to say whether they want, well, whether it's a good thing, a bad thing. All in all, we got pretty positive feedback after, and we also consulted, went around and held three big sessions out with the pastoralists in each town and stuff and got them to come in and sat down with the National Heritage Mob and really had a good, robust conversation about what it means for those guys and how it can also help them versus what it's doing for us as well. So I think that there's always, like anything, with a little bit of change, there's going to be a bit of kickback, but I think all in all, it's been a really good and positive experience to get this across the board and have those robust conversations with the pastoralists.
Josh Gorringe from the Mithika Aboriginal Corporation speaking with Crispian Yeomans. Weather's up next.
Here we go.
Coming to the ABC, new drama, Goolagong.
She's a natural.
Brand new dog park.
I'm happy with that handshake.
And so much more.
That's 2026.
Just you wait. On ABC TV and ABC iView.
This is the Country Hour. On ABC Radio Queensland.
And it's time to check in on the weather, and Geordie Kyrol joins me now from the Bureau of Meteorology. Good afternoon, Geordie.
Good afternoon, Megan.
So, what are the watch points around Queensland for the next couple of days?
Well, as we speak, there are some thunderstorms developing just north of Mount Isa and in the far northwest of Tunmanji. But apart from that, nothing else going on now. But still, the chance of an isolated thunderstorm today, particularly in the western districts of the state. These thunderstorms are not expected to be severe, as we have seen in the last few days and weeks, just maybe some gusty winds in some of them, but apart from that, elsewhere pretty sunny conditions, and this situation will continue in the next at least couple of days until Thursday. Thursday we could see some isolated showers that bring a little bit more rainfall, particularly in the Marino, Warrego and Darling Downs.
So with the thunderstorms that are potentially forming in that northwest western Queensland area, how much rain are you expecting in them?
Oh, we're not expecting much rain today with these thunderstorms. Just and they are very isolated, so a few millimeters at most. As I said before, mostly the hazard for these thunderstorms should be windy conditions.
Is there any risk of dry lightning?
Yeah, there's always, well, thunderstorms always have the risk of lightning. So yeah, that's a possibility, definitely.
Are those regions currently facing a high fire danger currently?
Yeah, that's right. So high-flying dangers are forecast to continue across much of the interior and the Gulf country today and over the coming days, even extending to the central coast tomorrow. So high-flying danger is still in place and it's forecast for today and the next coming days, particularly in the interior of the state.
Mm. And in regards to coastal waters, what's the latest with them?
So largely in the coastal water, in the east coast, largely 10 to 15 southeasterly, 10 to 15 knots southeasterly winds, and yeah, similar conditions for the next couple of days. This is due to a high pressure system that is located in the just north of New Zealand, and extending a ridge, so bringing these southeasterly winds 10 to 15 knots.
Hmm. And going to the Gulf country, how's coastal conditions in that part of Queensland?
Yeah, in the Gulf country, winds turning more northeasterly, but yeah, as well, 10 to 15 knots at most.
Hmm. So what's happening with the storms later in the week?
So pretty similar conditions today and in the next coming days. So the chance of a thunderstorm pretty much across the whole interior of the state, not so much across the coast, the eastern coast. And these thunderstorms, if they develop, they are not expecting to be severe, as we have seen in the past few days or weeks. And on Thursday, they could bring or leave up to 20 millimetres in parts of the Maranon, Warrego and the Darling Downs, particularly in the southern parts of the Darling Downs, and continue a little bit on Friday. And then from the weekend, the chance of a thunderstorm could extend pretty much across the whole state.
Okay, and what are temperatures doing this week?
Temperatures this week, as we mentioned before, we don't have currently a heat wave, a severe heat wave condition, but temperatures still warm, but just a little bit above average. Today, in the southern part of the state, the Maranon, Warrego, and the Darling Downs are a little bit above average, but pretty much near average elsewhere, and this situation will continue in the next few days, although the severe heat wave conditions could be back from tomorrow in the Gulf country.
Jordy, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure.
Jordy Kyrol is a forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology.
As each day begins,
get the facts you need to stay informed.
Every day, across your day,
stay with Australia's trusted news source.
Stay in the know with ABC News.
Go to news.abc.net.au or download the ABC News app.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Thousands of palm workers across the country have disengaged from the scheme. Yesterday on the Country Hour, we brought you the story of those that are leaving their employers and becoming extremely vulnerable in visa limbo. But there is work being done to help. One town in particular is stepping in and hoping to be a model community for other towns wanting to re-engage workers. As Lucy Cooper reports, it's all about implementing change from the ground up.
Towns across regional and rural Australia are grappling with disengaged workers, labourers who have left companies they were recruited to work for under the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility PALM scheme. Their visas are tied to their employer, so if they leave their job, their visas can be revoked. Since 2019, more than 7,000 workers have disengaged from the scheme. Many remain in Australia on bridging visas or are undocumented.
The government has largely left these workers, these people who've left the PALM scheme,
who are in these really vulnerable and precarious situations, the government's completely ignored it.
Kaya Barry, an academic with Griffith University, recently co-authored a report looking into their situation.
We know that there's thousands of people out there who need support, but, you know, once they're formally exited from the Palm Scheme visa, it's like everybody turns a blind eye.
But there is one town wanting to change this.
You might see as you drive in, we have a sign, don't we, saying we welcome immigrants and refugees and new settlers. So they know we've got open arms.
That's George Weston. He's the mayor of Leeton Shire Council.
We've got a great heart. We have a multiculturalism organisation who go out of the way. They take them to the hospital, they look after them, they help them with filling out forms at the local, our local library to try and get their visas organised, try and get as much information as possible.
Home to about 9,000 people, Leeton is about 6 hours from Sydney. It's located in the Riverina region, known as the Food Bowl of New South Wales, a crucial agricultural region putting food on the plates of millions of Australians.
We can help them. We can look after them. We can use them. And Australia can use them as well.
Leeton Shire Council is a founding member of the Mayoral Alliance for the Pacific, which aims for better outcomes for Palm Scheme workers and the communities they work in.
We're trying to lobby the federal government. There's DFAT and Dwyer and Home Affairs, because they're all just different silos, and we're trying to get them together and say, hey, we've got a problem here. These people are worthy people, or they've been disengaged, but how about we get them back into the workplace, you know? Can you reevaluate and look at this?
Most of the disengaged workers in Leeton have moved there through word of mouth. Seeking connection and support, Leeton welcomes them with open arms.
It makes me really proud of Leeton, the welcoming that we do. Every individual here go out the way to help people. It makes you feel really great.
And it's not just the council which is pushing for better outcomes for disengaged workers.
We get the fallout from the Palm Scheme from other locations where they come to Leeton. I will give my 100% support to Palm, but I can't support something where I see the failings that I believe we can address.
Paul Matem was the mayor of Leeton for 16 years and now leads the town's multicultural support group. He's long advocated for greater support for workers under the Palm Scheme who feel they have no choice but to leave.
They've said they're too frightened to speak out because they're worried that they'll be sent back home, and in some cases been told that they will go home. There'd be a huge void if suddenly they all had to go home. So if we can make it work, we can find a pathway, and we need to give them confidence that they can sit down and talk to not only people like myself, but others that we're connected to within Home Affairs and others to say, let's find a way.
He started briefing the new workers who come to Leeton under the Palm Scheme. He hopes these meet and greets where he chats with them about the local sport teams and where to seek help if they're struggling will keep more workers in the scheme and reduce disengagement.
I'm just an ordinary guy, and I just feel that, you know, you can sit down and talk to these people, smile with them, help them along the way as much as you can. And I think they have that trust then, and when they have trust, they don't have fear. And if they got fear, well, obviously things don't work as we'd love to see them work.
At JBS Riverina, a beef feedlot, farm and processing facility, Palm Scheme workers are a crucial part of the workforce. Inorke Knox, Colony Singer, works at JBS as the Palm Support and Engagement Officer.
We believe in the workers' welfare being paramount and very important to our production as well. If the workers are looked after well outside of work, it will show on the numbers at work as well.
From Fiji and Samoa, Knox said his background helps him understand the workers better.
I know their backgrounds because I was from there and I live here as well. So if there's anyone that could help integrate them into the Australian community, that would be someone like me, someone who lives in both worlds.
Paul Matem hopes these roles and ideas which Leeton is trying to implement will become a model for the rest of the country.
We should never, ever, ever have that a person is fearful for their job.
Report author Kaya Barry is calling on the federal government to implement reforms to keep workers in the scheme.
This has already stretched on for years for some of these people who are just off the grid, really vulnerable, in pretty horrific conditions most of the time.
A key one is mobility, allowing for workers to easily change employers in the scheme.
Mobility is the operative word. I mean, and to be mobile, you need to be able to move from one employer down the road to the next employer. If those amendments were made to the Palm Scheme, by the government, then that would be something which could be looked upon, I think, quite favourably.
That's Michael Pyers. He's the General Manager of Workplace Relations and Legal Affairs with the National Farmers Federation. He said it would be timely if a review into the operations of and lack of pay transparency associated with labour hire companies were to occur.
If you do nothing and if you just leave it as it is now that your visa is tied to this particular farm, then if the farm worker is unhappy, they will disengage. They will take matters into their own hands anyway.
The chance to easily move between employers is also endorsed by the workers themselves. Wayne Levy from Solomon Islands said he would never have left the Palm scheme if he just had the opportunity to change jobs.
If I can go back to the Palm scheme, no problem. Yeah. I enjoy the work. I want to just earn money to support my family. But the problem is that one. Yeah, there is no transparency at all when they're doing the pay and all these things.
Wayne Levy from Solomon Islands ending that report from Lucy Cooper. Now, if you want to listen back to yesterday's story on Palm Scheme workers, you can check out the Country Hour on the ABC Listen app. It's free to download and it lets you choose when and where to listen live right now, or you can catch up on great interviews and programs you may have missed. You can search for your local ABC station, or you can even search for the Queensland Country Hour. Just head to the App Store on your device or to abc.net.au/listen on your computer to download it. It is 15 minutes to one. Up next, I'll introduce you to one of Cattle Australia's 2026 National Beef Leaders.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour on your radio, online, and on the ABC Listen app.
ABC Capricornia's weekly newsletter delivers the weekly local news, stories, recipes and weather from around the region. Go to abc.net.au/Capricornia/newsletter.
A young Cloncurry cattle producer has been named as one of Cattle Australia's 2026 National Beef Leaders. Now, this program, it's designed for people in agriculture between 21 and 35 years of age who are looking to get into leadership and into those advocacy roles. Ben Reardon has worked across Northern Australia's cattle industry for more than a decade now, and he's currently managing a station in northwest Queensland. He tells Madeline McCosker the program is a chance to help bridge the gap between policy and producer application.
Yeah, National Beef Leaders Program is a succession plan for the Cattle Australia board, and it's sort of their flagship program to influence young people with policy and advocacy for our industry, being Cattle Australia, which is our grass-fed body. So I see it a great opportunity to get down to Canberra, see how governance works, see how policy's created. That's something that, yeah, I think the program does really well, as well as, yeah, seeing the likes of how your David Foots and Gary Edwards, there are lots of them fellas, how they operate and advocate for our industry.
Mm. And you have said previously that you want to use this practical experience that you're going to gain through this role to bridge the gap between policy and I guess the way that's applied on the ground as producers. So I guess where do you think we need to see the improvement in that space?
I think there's a lot of transparency between the grass-fed bodies and on a producer level, but I think there is a massive disconnect on where stuff goes or where producers' levies are going and how that's filtered back through the system. I think there is a disconnect there still. So I think bridging that disconnect on a producer level first is the biggest influence, I think. And then secondly, creating more transparency for our city-like viewer.
Yeah. And in terms of sort of the possibility to influence policy, how do you think that can help the industry on a wider scale and filter down to, you know, the producer level as yourself as a producer and, you know, you're managing cattle and land? So how do you think those two things can work together?
I think that just by being part of the likes of this program, and probably more so for myself, you just have a greater and broader understanding of how that policy is created, why it's created, what are the more global economic factors surrounding why that's created. And you've just got, I think, more of a broader idea of why that exists. For what we're doing with National Beef Leaders Program, I don't think there's a hell of a lot that we can do as far as we're only the juniors in that whole table. But I think we can really get an understanding of why they're created and the more global economic factors that go into why they are created.
Mm. And, I mean, you've been part of the industry for 14 years or so now. So how do you think your time within the industry in Northern Australia in particular is going to help you as a beef leader in this program?
I think the sheer scale we have in Northern Australia is what gives us a big draw card as Northern producers. For how we can advocate for industry, like obviously Northern Australia is very much, our workforce is built on the back of young people. So I think the more young people we can keep coming through and giving them a broader and greater understanding of why things are in place and why we do them, I think that's the biggest draw card I can have and I can influence and surrounding Northern Australia.
Mm. And you're part of a wider cohort, I guess, of beef leaders from across the country. So I guess what are you hoping to take home or to learn from the rest of the group in this experience?
I think we've got a really wide variety of us within the group. Like there's a couple of Northern guys, there's some Southern guys. I think probably just we're both very different production systems from the Southern guys to the Northern guys. I think seeing how that bridge overlaps and what are the similarities between the Northern and the Southern system, I think that's a bit of a strength we've got with our cohort.
Awesome. They were all the questions I was looking to ask today, Ben. Anything else you want to add in there that you think's worth mentioning?
No, Matty, I just think it's a great opportunity to be a part of something like National Beef Leaders, and there's not enough people that want to put their hand up to be in things like Cattle Australia and more so get on boards and that and advocate for industry. I think that there's a lot of people that are happy to sit back and whinge about industry, but not enough people that want to advocate for industry. So that's my...
Totally.
Yeah.
And I think kind of what you were saying there, people with your experience within the industry moving into those roles on boards and these advocacy groups is really important to make sure that they are still, advocating for the industry in a way that's beneficial for the industry.
Yeah, I completely agree, Matty. I think no matter which way you go, like something like Cattle Australia is such a great advocacy because at a root level, everyone who's a beef producer is a grass-fed producer at some point in supply chain. Whether or not you go all the way through with the grass-fed chain or you divert and go down the high-end grain-fed, at some point they were a grass cow-calf operator. So I think that's why Cattle Australia is so important to our industry.
Ben Reardon is the Cloncurry Station Manager and the 2026 National Beef Leader, speaking with Madeline McCosker. I don't think this will be the last time that you and I will hear from Ben. I imagine we'll hear from him a number of times as he's making his way through and pursuing that, that path into advocacy roles through Cattle Australia. And, I'm certain we'll hear a lot more from him.
Top Entertainment's just a heartbeat away.
You just got to know where to look.
The Family Next Door, Return to Paradise, Portrait Artist of the Year, Austin and Mystery Road Origin, where it's always free, always entertaining, ABC iView.
The Country Hour, celebrating 80 years.
Every year's different.
The Country Hour.
It's about connecting with people.
Part of your community for 80 years.
Beautiful.
Weekdays at noon on ABC Radio and on the ABC Listen app.
When I first joined in November of 1964, the first shots were being fired in the move to introduce the reserve price scheme in wool. You remember that, you mightn't, but people were sort of arguing across fence lines. Families were split by the decisions that people were making, and it was really a hard time for the wool grower. Well, I, as a young man, was a bit confused by this, but anyway, we went along with it. As you know, it lasted until about 1990 when we saw it fall over at Roma.
That's the late Colin Munro, former head of the ABC Rural Department, reflecting on the rise and fall of the wool floor price. Hello, I'm Annie Brown, and this year the Country Hour marks 80 years since it first went to air on ABC Radio on December 3rd, 1945. Let's head back to the 1970s. It was a turbulent time for Australian farmers, with many markets down. But for struggling wool growers, it was a time of change. In 1974, the much-debated wool floor price was introduced. The Australian Wool Reserve Price Scheme was set up to smooth out fluctuations in the market and give producers a minimum price for their wool. This is a report for the Country Hour by John Parker in 1974.
There's no doubt that most growers agree that there's a need for a floor price to be announced. The two organisations who claim to represent all of Australia's wool growers, the AWMPF and the AWGC, have both said they want an announced floor price and that it should be 300 cents a kilo for 21 micron wool. They won't accept anything less, and they think it should be announced before the new season. The feeling generally among wool growers could be summed up in this comment from New South Wales wool grower David Hodgkinson.
I think that the sooner they make it and end the uncertainty in the industry, the better, both from the overseas buyer's point of view and from ours.
What would happen, do you think, if they don't?
Well, I think that we'll see a repeat of the early 1970s, where you'll see sheep being sold off and the Australian wool clip going down again very rapidly.
Do you think growers generally would welcome some government announcement on a reserve price?
I'm sure that they would welcome it, and I'm sure that it would be good for Australia in the long run, because I'm quite sure that the government would make a profit on whatever the price they put in.
It seems that all agree then there should be announced floor price. The difficulty is, who should announce it, the government or the corporation? Whether a floor price is set or not depends on the government, but will it work? The chairman of Economic Wool Producers, Mr. Jim Maple-Brown, told us that for a fixed floor price to operate, the government would need to hold 5 to 10 million bales of wool, and it would cost about $2,000 million to operate.
The government did come on board and the scheme operated for 17 years. However, it was abandoned in 1991 despite protests from producers who wanted to keep it. In short, it led to a massive unsellable stockpile of wool, and the Australian Wool Corporation went broke trying to maintain the price. At the time, the AWC had 4.6 million bales of wool and a net debt of $2.4 billion. It was often referred to by the media as the Wool Mountain. This is then Minister for Primary Industries John Kerin speaking to the ABC in 1991.
You said earlier today it was your most difficult decision ever. How difficult?
Oh, very. This is the Holy Grail. The reserve price scheme's been there 17 years. This came about as a result of a very bitter debate in the 1960s. This is a very tough decision.
And will this decision work this time, do you think?
Yes.
Over what period? 5 years?
Well, that's the idea.
And what will have happened to your average wool grower's income over that period of time?
They are not going to have very good incomes over this period. I believe they'll have better incomes than they would have if they tried to stay and continue to buy their own wool and try and set a price that the market had walked away from.
In the aftermath, many wool producers left the industry. And in 2025, it was predicted Australian wool production would fall to its lowest level in more than 100 years. Today, prices fluctuate based on market conditions, primarily driven by demand from China. China is the world's largest wool processing country, receiving about 85% of Australia's wool. Celebrating 80 years of rural stories on the Country Hour, I'm Annie Brown. And it is time to check in on the markets. Let's first cross to the Roma store sale.
With the selling season coming to a close, Roma agents yarded 9,455 head, all the regular buyers attending and active. The overall quality was not up to the standard of the previous week. The market, however, was strong. At the time of this interim report, the only steers 200 to 80 kilos sold from 470 cents to 592 cents a kilo to restockers. The only steer 280 to 330 kilos made to 600 cents to average 543 cents a kilo to restockers. The only steers 330 to 400 kilos sold to 562 to restockers and 5.24 cents a kilo to lot feeders. Yearling steers 440 kilos lost ground and make to 514 cents to lot feeders. Growing steers 500-600 kilos to 4.24 cents a kilo to lot feeders and 4.36 cents a kilo to restockers. Growing steers 600-750 kilos to 4.60 cents to processors. Bulls 450-600 kilos to 4.02 and bulls over 600 kilos to 3.90 cents a kilo to restockers. This has been David Fenn from National Livestock Reporting Service at Roma.
And the Warwick cattle sale.
Good afternoon. Despite some rain over parts of the supply area, the number of cattle for the second last sale before the annual break at Warwick increased by 158 head to 1,776. There was a large variation in quality across the young cattle, and this was reflected in prices. Heavyweight yearling steers to feed averaged 8 better. Cows could not maintain the levels of the previous sale, and the better end of the cows averaged 5 less. Export buyer activity was also not as good as the previous weeks. Lightweight yearling steers returning to paddock made to 536 to average from 497 to 501. Yearling steers to feed for domestic market made to 544 to average from 470 to 501.
And that's all we have time for on the Country Hour. News is coming up next. It is 1 o'clock.